Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Skip Rhodes, past chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and your moderator for this evening. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. This program is being held in association with the Northern California Peace Corps Association. Tonight's program will focus on the African country of Liberia. Liberia was founded by freed African slaves in the early 1800s and today serves as a dual symbol of both the concerns and the optimism that are possible for the African continent. Tonight, we will talk to several Bay Area women who traveled to Liberia under the auspices of the Carter Center, which is founded by former President Jimmy Carter and his wife, Rosalind, in 1982. But first, let me say a few words about the Carter Center and the people the center serves. It's a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization, and the center was created to advance peace and health worldwide. Since its founding, the Carter Center has helped to improve life for people in more than 1770 countries by resolving conflicts, advancing democracy, human rights, and economic opportunity, as well as preventing diseases, improving mental health care, and teaching farmers in developing nations to increase crop production. The Carter Center works in some of the world's poorest and most unstable environments, where the people live under extremely difficult conditions, isolated by poverty, disease, and insecurity. The goals of the center, whether through its peace or health work, are to advance human rights and alleviate unnecessary human suffering, building hopes in communities by showing people how they can improve their own lives, building the expectation that a better future is possible and is deserved. In November 2009, a group of Bay Area women traveled to Liberia to see the Carter Center's programs in action. A year earlier, they had heard President Carter describe the center's approach as a partner with communities to solve difficult, complex problems no one else was effectively addressing. They were inspired and wanted to see the work in action in person. This evening, these panelists will share their insights with you. One of those women with us tonight is Kate Biggs, a journalist, who, along with her colleague, photographer Nancy Ferris, traveled with the group to help document the experience. Kate Biggs is a freelance writer and consultant specializing in global affairs. She is the founder of Writing for Global Engagement, providing reportage and communication products for donor education and public outreach. Clients have included the Carter Center, Mercy Corps, Photo Philanthropy, World Savvy, and the Axis of Hope. She is also the lead author of the World Savvy Monitor, an online publication providing background and perspectives on current international news, and has her own blog, Grasping Global Poverty. Recently, she traveled in Rwanda, Liberia, and Ghana to help tell stories from the field. Nancy Ferris, whose photographs those in the room will see here tonight, could not be here. She's a social documentary photographer and founder of Photo Philanthropy, connecting photographs and photographers with nonprofit organizations around the world to tell stories that drive social change. Kate and Nancy's work on behalf of the Carter Center to document what is so unique and exciting about the center's Liberia initiative has been donated by Photo Philanthropy. We are going to start the evening with a presentation by Kate to give you some background and content and context on Liberia and the Carter Center's work there. Then our esteemed panel of women will answer questions about the trip and their experience in the field on this one-of-a-kind journey. So I'd now like to turn it over to Kate Biggs. Kate?
Thanks, Skip, and thanks to all of you for coming out on a rainy night to talk about Liberia. If some of you are sitting there thinking, Liberia, I was really kind of hoping for some insight on the situation in Libya, I have to disappoint you, but also assure you that you are not alone. When Nancy and I first went to Liberia, we got a lot of the Libya-Liberia confusion. We got some Lebanon-Liberia confusion. But my very favorite was when someone said to me, wow, won't it be cold there? I said, nope, that would be Siberia. I'm up here tonight because as a writer and lifelong student of Africa and international development work, I am fascinated by Liberia. It is, to me, a mosaic of all that is troubling as well as all that can be celebrated on the continent in the 21st century. Illustrative of the challenges faced by many African countries, it is an intense laboratory where debates about how to meet these challenges are currently playing out, a place to learn, to be inspired, and to be humbled. This is what motivated Nancy and me to visit Liberia in 2009 on an independent documentary project to capture, in faces and stories, how the development community is working to produce a new paradigm of aid that works in Africa. On that trip, we spent time with many different NGOs. We also met with the head of the United Nations Development Program. We spoke to government officials, to people on the street in Monrovia, and in villages in rural counties. We even interviewed President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf herself. But it was the day we spent with Pee-wee Flamoku, a Liberian national who works for the Carter Center, that affected us most. What we heard that day, bumping along the pitted road from Monrovia to Bushrod Island, and what we saw at a Carter Center-supported village run by Liberian icon Mama Tuma, lured us to return to the equatorial heat of Liberia, specifically to see more of the Carter Center's programs. We packed up our cameras and notebooks again and joined the West Africa trip being organized by the Carter Center. My role here tonight is to provide you with some context for the stories you will hear about the trip. I will tell you why Liberia is important and a bit about the Carter Center's history and current presence in the country. I'll introduce you to one of the Carter Center's signature programs in Liberia and show you how the work reflects the values and philosophies of the organization as a whole. These stories are really about a unique partnership that is developing between Liberia and the Carter Center, both by design and organically, grounded in rigorous research and experience, nimble and creative. A model of social innovation and entrepreneurship crafted upon age-old notions of very basic human rights and human needs. A partnership that is helping to bring about profound social change in one of the world's most wounded places. So first of all, why Liberia? Well, at a primal level, because as Americans, it's in our DNA. Of the 54 countries on the African continent, the small nation of Liberia is the one with whom the United States shares the most history and connection. Not many know that Liberia was in fact founded by freed American slaves in the early 1800s. Freed slaves literally put on ships back to Africa by a white colonization society that was motivated only partly by high-minded ideals. It was straight-up pragmatism as much as it was dedication to freedom from which the idea of Liberia was born, as former slave owners contemplated the conundrum of living side by side with their former chattel in the U.S. Nevertheless, these American-born Liberian settlers and their descendants went on to establish Africa's first black independent republic, modeled on the U.S. system of government. They named their cities after U.S. presidents and fashioned their homes on the architecture of the southern plantations they had left. They also brought with them American notions of class, recreating the social divisions they had escaped and subjugating the indigenous Africans they encountered, much as they themselves had been subjugated by whites in the U.S. From these complicated origins, Liberians and Americans have remained entwined, genealogically and geopolitically. Liberia was an ally of the United States during the Cold War, serving as a hub for intelligence, communication, and shipping signals on the continent. Such are the ties that Liberians often refer to their nation as the little brother of the United States, a sibling relationship that has, like sibling relationships everywhere, been characterized by ups and downs, elements of both favoritism and neglect. Why Liberia? Because its story is staggering and jaw-dropping. And because unlike the Belgian Congo or French Rwanda, this tragedy is partly ours. In 1989, racked by decades of inequality, corruption, and ethnic strife, many would say aided and abetted by U.S. leaders, Liberia exploded into a brutal civil war that would last nearly 14 years, laying waste to the country, traumatizing its people, and gutting the very social fabric of its communities. When war finally ended in 2003 with the departure of dictator Charles Taylor, 270,000 Liberians had died, and 1.5 million, fully half the population, were forced to flee their homes. In terms of the U.S. population, that would be 27 million dead, 150 million displaced. Imagine that in our country. Oxford economist Paul Collier has called war development in reverse, and you would be hard-pressed to find a better modern example of this than Liberia. Once a middle-income country and a West African commercial and cultural hub, Liberia has the distinction of experiencing the greatest percent decline in GDP and quality of life ever recorded. The country was quite literally destroyed. At war's end, when it was possible to even begin measuring such things again, Liberia could be found dead last, or near last, in the world, on lists that we use to calculate and categorize human suffering and deprivation. 80% of its people living below the poverty line, 85% unemployed. 1 in 8 children dying in their first year of life. 1 in 5 dying before their 5th birthday. 1 in 100 women dying from pregnancy or childbirth, compared with 1 in 100,000 in some European countries. Life expectancy, 40 years. One of the 10 countries in the world where the highest percentage of people routinely go hungry and die from malnutrition. To make matters worse, as development ground to a halt and reversed, the very organizations whose job it is to help people in extreme need were largely chased out of the country by the violence and instability. And it wasn't just the international aid agencies who were forced to leave, but most of Liberia's educated and professional classes, resulting in one of the continent's most dramatic examples of brain drain that would last through the present day. Just now are Liberian nationals beginning to return with their skills, nearly all of them making huge personal and financial sacrifices to do so. When peace finally came to Liberia in 2003, the development challenges were epic. Everything needed rebuilding and reconceiving. Not only livelihoods, homes, schools, government buildings, bridges, roads, electricity grids, water systems, ports and airports, but also hearts, minds, and souls. The war had touched every single person in this country of 3 million people in some way. The task was nothing less than building a nation starting from square one, actually starting behind square one when you factor in the debilitating legacy of 14 years of war, the things that did survive, wounds, grievances, isolation, and mistrust. Shortly after peace accords were signed, a veritable army of donor nations, UN agencies, NGOs, faith-based organizations, scholars, experts, and dedicated individuals began to pour into the country, trying to get the lights on, the schools open, the people talking, and the mojo back. Through the present day, 10,000 UN peacekeepers and the U.S. military keep the lid on security concerns. Democratic elections in 2005 peacefully installed Harvard-educated President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, the continent's first female head of state, who immediately engaged with local, regional, and international players to show that there are African solutions to African problems. So why Liberia? Because if you are interested in development, a topic that is often discussed in these halls, I think there's perhaps no better place to experience what development looks like in all its raw and tragic and hopeful iterations. In this new millennium in which the United Nations has made it a priority through the MDGs to eradicate extreme poverty from the face of the world, many eyes are on Liberia as a case study of how to help the poorest of the poor. Ironically, in immediate post-war Liberia, there wasn't much left to unwind in terms of past aid strategies that today we know are ineffective. At square one, there is the opportunity to start fresh and do more of what we know works and less of what we know doesn't. Liberia has become an incubator for the best practices in the field, a proving ground for new approaches and lessons learned from that last half century of development work from around the globe. That's what makes it so relevant. The country is a hive of activity, debate, and reinvention. The Carter Center is a big part of this story. Not many know that the Carter Center has actually had a long relationship with Liberia. President Carter was the first U.S. president to make an official state visit to the country in 1978. In the 1990s, the Carter Center helped to negotiate ceasefires and organize elections during a brief interlude in Liberia's civil war. The center left Liberia with most of the international community during the height of the Taylor years, but was invited back in 2003 with the immense task of consolidating the agreements that had ended the war and preparing the country for a new constitution and elections. This mandate quickly expanded as the Carter Center listened to Liberians talk about their needs and aspirations. From its peace and election work grew other programs that in turn sprouted legs into other critical areas identified by Liberians as they worked to get their country up and running. In development jargon, you might call this a community-based capacity-building strategy, a layering strategy, or a capable states approach. But Mama Tuma, one of Liberia's best-known traditional leaders, a woman who is said to have been born with gray hair as a sign of her future power and influence, perhaps says it better when she told us, "Before you can walk, you have to hold someone's hand. The Carter Center is that hand." And she is just one of the local leaders who work closely with Carter Center staff in Liberia in a relationship built over time and from a place of mutual respect and dialogue. Take a deep dive into places like Mama Tuma's village, and you get it. Visually, intellectually, and viscerally, the Carter Center is part of the very marrow of this country in transition. The Carter Center brings not only its extensive experience in post-conflict situations around the world, but also a familiarity with the distinctly Liberian context in which this particular peace must be waged. The center's mission is to fill gaps left by other organizations. In Liberia, this niche quickly presented itself in a critical area, increasing citizen access to justice. Martin Luther King Jr. famously said, "Without justice, there can be no peace." But what does this mean, access to justice? Those of us who live in places with functioning justice systems don't often stop to think what goes into building a society based on rule of law. We tend to be more preoccupied with the grinding of the wheels and the occasional glitches that we forget the enormity of what it takes to even get those wheels in place and moving at all. Consider Liberia at the end of the war. It's fair to say that pretty much everything having to do with justice had been damaged and discredited. Both the formal justice system, the government's laws, and the informal justice system, made up of tribal, traditional, and customary laws, which tend to prevail at the rural village level where half of Liberia's population lives. Both systems had failed and were in disarray, leaving the country vulnerable to a resumption of war and without the means to restore and maintain order on any level. Liberians were left unsure of their rights and how to protect their livelihoods or seek recourse when their rights were violated. You name it, it had to be done. Writing a new constitution and a full set of laws articulating the principles and values of society, ranging from human rights to property rights to civil and criminal matters. Stakeholders needed to be brought into the process from all around the country and every ethnic, age, gender, and special interest group. A police force had to be trained to investigate crimes and enforce the laws without past corruption. Prosecutors, lawyers, and judges had to be trained to impartially evaluate and apply these laws. Most importantly, faith and trust in law had to be cultivated and tested among the Liberian people who were used to being deceived, neglected, or exploited by sources of authority. And all these things, daunting under the best of circumstances, are trickier in Liberia because of the dual nature of justice in the country. Formal laws recognized primarily in urban areas, and informal laws that guide community-based justice in the villages and rural areas. Inevitably, most citizens of Liberia end up handling their affairs in a mix between the two different sets of laws. Yet the two systems can be at odds with each other, and you can often get a different verdict depending on which system you access. Sometimes the two systems differ fundamentally in definitions of right and wrong, especially where women are concerned. Tribal laws regarding child marriage, marital rape, domestic violence, inheritance, and property rights often run afoul of modern sensibilities and human rights principles now espoused in Liberia's constitution. How do you reconcile the contradictions in these two systems? This is what the Carter Center's Access to Justice program is all about. Piwi Flomoku, who I mentioned before, was our guru as we tried to understand the complexities of the situation and the Carter Center approach. Piwi knows what the absence of justice looks like. Having been born and raised in Liberia and experiencing the war and its aftermath, working as an AP reporter and photographer. He is now a senior project coordinator for the Carter Center, and it seems everyone in the country knows Piwi. He explained in his lyrical mix of Liberian and American English that you cannot simply just write off ancient cultural practices and legacies as outdated and anachronistic. He reminded us that traditional or informal systems are the only justice many Liberians have ever known, or ever trusted. Some surveys indicate that 2/3 of all Liberians do not trust the formal justice system, which has been historically erratic and corrupt. Plus, Piwi noted, there are practices and beliefs within tribal systems that serve vital, productive purposes in society. And we are talking about a population that is still reeling from fairly recent war and upheaval. This tends to be a time when people cling to comforting and familiar rituals and turn to age-old customs to help restore a sense of order. From this place of respect, the Carter Center engages both formal and informal systems to help construct a new hybrid justice model that will work in Liberia. We saw the Carter Center staff do this by attending not only to the more technocratic aspects of justice reform, but also to the human side. Understanding deeply that traditional communities cannot be expected to change overnight, especially if they are not convinced of the viability of new formal legal mechanisms. And until they come to trust that the new system provides sensible, convenient, relative, and fair alternatives to century-old customs. That way, it doesn't matter where or how you access justice, in a Monrovia courtroom or a village Palava Hut council. When values and norms come into alignment across the country, rule of law helps knit society back together. It occurred to me that what makes the Carter Center approach so unique and so effective is that the organization works at many different levels and all along the spectrum, with the crafters, the agents, and the consumers of justice. The crafters, the agents, and the consumers of justice. This is key. In doing so, the center is bridging historic divides between formal and informal justice within the Liberian government, between the national and local governments, among the different ministries, between men and women, international NGOs and local grassroots groups, rural and urban populations, young and old. They do this by catalyzing partnerships and by modeling a partnership mentality for others. You can't go far in any direction without hearing praise for the Kata Senta, as it is called in Liberia. They have true street credibility, yet keep a low profile and create space for local ownership of ideas and innovations. As we dug into all of this, it occurred to me how totally, totally vital the center's work is here. If you think about it, justice underpins everything. It's not just about preventing another war. From housing, education and healthcare, to employment, land rights, banking, and trade. In short, everything that goes into development rests on a foundation of laws that everyone recognizes. Without a justice system they trust, people go outside the law to get their needs met, and many do not get their needs met at all. Corruption, cronyism, and violence fill the vacuum. Foreign aid and investment go astray or are chased away. Ethnic cleavages and fault lines in the population are exacerbated. In fact, many believe that lack of fairly applied justice is what led to war in Liberia in the first place. It's important, it seems, to get it right this time around. When we set out to see what all this looks like on the ground, we were surprised at the boisterous, chaotic, jubilant nature of the work. Rule of law is one of those terms that can instantly make your eyes glaze over. You may even be glazing over now. But in communities across Liberia, it involves songs and drumming, tears and laughter, stories and dancing. It's beautifully, wondrously messy. We would typically arrive at a village to be greeted by throngs of people, all ages, speaking different languages, some in traditional African garb, some in jeans and tank tops, some in suit and tie, some clad in the ubiquitous blue Carter Center t-shirt. The noise and energy would slap us back in the African heat. At first, we had trouble shedding our Western lenses. We would whip out our notebooks and try to make sense of it all, asking, but who works for the Carter Center? Who are the government officials? Who are the chiefs? Who are the grassroots organizations? The community leaders? Who is in charge? How do you tell the clients from the staff, from the volunteers? Where is the flowchart? Often there wasn't even a sign anywhere proclaiming the presence of the Carter Center. There were no speeches by Carter Center expat staff pronouncing bold schemes or claiming credit for things. This is not what we as philanthropists and students of development work were used to seeing. But slowly we realized this is exactly the point. There is profound, impactful madness, method to the madness, madness too. This is what true community-based capacity building looks like. Here's what we found. Sometimes it seems it's really sexy work. Meeting with high-level government officials, cabinet ministers, tribal elders and chiefs, as well as world-renowned experts and regional bigwigs. Convening people who don't usually get together to have conversations they don't usually have. Sometimes it is highly technical. Writing laws, researching and applying precedents gleaned from work in other countries. Or sending out merry bands of CLAs or community legal advisors to help resolve specific disputes or train civil servants and village leaders in mediation. Sometimes it's more like social work, listening, walking people through crises in their lives, helping them to find the things they need, even things outside the Carter Center purview, from medical assistance to food to a sewing machine to a ride into town. If what people need doesn't exist, the Carter Center will help create it, like the school, domestic violence crisis center, or commercial weaving business found at Mama Tuma's village. Sometimes it's purely logistical, doing things that other organizations consider too small, like providing transportation and meals to local groups so they can meet amongst themselves or participate in national dialogues, or translating signs and documents into the 20 different languages Liberians speak, or setting up community radio that can reach the 1.5 million people who cannot read. Sometimes it's creative and unconventional, like supporting a drama group that goes around to rural villages, acting out vignettes designed to educate people about laws and rights. This was one of our favorites. A Carter Center-supported drama troupe doing Saturday Night Live-type skits, hilarious and poignant, on how to resolve certain types of disputes or modeling how husbands should treat their wives under new laws. Often it is spontaneous and unscripted, as when Carter Center staff travel to hotspots to defuse potentially dangerous situations as they arise in the moment, such as they have done recently in areas receiving large influxes of Ivory Coast refugees or where ethnic or political violence has flared. Always it is done with respect and humility and a true spirit of partnership. And who does this work? For the most part, Liberian citizens. For the Carter Center trains and leaves human capacity in country. And they work from a strength-based, not a deficit-based mindset, seeing and believing in the capabilities of their local community partners. As Monrovia's traditional queen, Julie Indy, told us, after directing a dance festival in honor of our trip leader, Anna Mahan's coronation as honorary Chief Bessie, poverty is all around us, but poverty is not in us. Think about that one. Poverty is all around us, but poverty is not in us. It's important to note that Carter Center staff work only in places where they have been invited to work, yet they are apolitical in nature. It occurs to me what a fine line this is. The center must be in the country at the behest of its leaders, yet resist the gravitational pull of influence and power to maintain their independence. Tom Crick is the Carter Center's Liberia expert and associate director of conflict resolution programs. Some of our most enlightening moments of the trip came as we drank beer in the Arctic temperatures of the Mamba Point Hotel bar with Tom after a day spent in the field. When we pressed him with questions about the upcoming re-election bid of President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, he told us that the job of the Carter Center is to be supportive of the process, not necessarily the person. He notes that a success of the Carter Center's work here is to make the president's job easier on many fronts, but in the big picture, to often empower local citizens to make the president's job harder through transparency, media, and general civil society checks and balances. A big part of this effort is supporting the inclusion of all Liberians in the process. Women, the elderly, children, rural and tribal populations. These are among the previously marginalized groups that now have a voice, thanks to the broad outreach of the center and their work here. And the process is better for it. Really, it seems to me, in the end, to be all about changing expectations, helping people to expect more, giving them the voice to express their expectations, and enhancing the capacity of government to meet those expectations. I suspect this is what Jimmy Carter means when he talks about building hope. There is much more to tell you. I should note that the Carter Center website has great information on the Access to Justice program, and also other programs in Liberia, such as the exciting new mental health initiative that has just been launched in partnership between the Carter Center and the Liberian Ministry of Health. For those of you who heard Rosalind Carter here at the Commonwealth Club last year, this may be of special interest. It's the first time the Carter Center is taking its domestic mental health work to international settings. There just generally aren't programs like this in developing countries. Consider this. Liberia has exactly one practicing psychiatrist for a population of over 3 million people. And it is estimated that half the population suffers from clinically defined symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. As I wrap up, I will quickly round out my mandate of telling you everything you need to know about Liberia in 30 minutes or less by giving you a quick update on what Liberia is facing in the year ahead. The big news on the street is the upcoming presidential and congressional elections, only the second since the war, which are scheduled to take place this fall. Incumbent President Johnson Sirleaf is currently thought to be the frontrunner, but there is a lot that can happen in the next 6 months. Many worry about the logistics of holding a national election in a country with very little infrastructure in the rainy season. Getting people to the polls is going to be challenging, as is ensuring that Liberians are aware of and can meaningfully participate in weighing the issues in the campaign. The Carter Center is already on it. You've probably heard about the post-election violence in neighboring Ivory Coast, with whom Liberia shares a 450-mile border. Violence next door is never a good thing. And it has resulted in a significant refugee crisis, as 150,000 Ivorians fleeing their homes have flooded into Liberia's impoverished border counties, stressing scarce resources and contributing to ethnic tensions. Everyone is also watching The Hague, where former Liberian dictator Charles Taylor is on trial for international war crimes and crimes against humanity. Interestingly, he is not on trial there for crimes committed in Liberia, but rather for his involvement with rebels in neighboring Sierra Leone's civil war, including the use of child soldiers and forays into blood diamonds. It is thought that's how he funded his own civil war in Liberia. Most expect the court to delay its verdict until after Liberia's elections, out of fears that the outcome could stir up Taylor's former associates still at large throughout the country. Speaking of war crimes, nobody has yet to be brought to justice for the horrors of Liberia's civil war. A truth and reconciliation process is currently underway, modeled on that of Rwanda and South Africa. And finally, a development that we know from history and current events can be a good or a bad thing for the everyday people of a developing country. Oil has apparently been discovered off Liberia's coast, and Chevron has recently opened an office in the capital of Monrovia. These are all issues to watch in the coming months and years, and you can be assured the Carter Center will be watching them too. Thank you again for coming tonight, and I also want to thank Anna and Sima for organizing the wonderful trip that we were on. And now I will turn it back over to Skip.
Thank you very much, Kate. You really set the context for the last portion of our program, and I would like to ask the panelists to please join Kate up here on the podium, and I'll introduce the other panelists. To Kate Biggs' left, to your right, is Kate Ridgway, who has been a friend of the Carter Center since 2005 and has respected the work of Jimmy Carter since her school days. In November 2010, Kate and her husband hosted President Carter to speak about the center's work around the world. She then conceived of a trip in which she and other similarly motivated women could see these programs in action, and thus the idea for the center's first donor trip was launched. Kate has a master's degree in education from Stanford, is a former mountaineer and outward instructor in Colorado. She and her husband live in Woodside, where they're raising three wonderful children. Next to Kate, Emily Ogden grew up with Kate in Southern California. Currently, Emily resides in Mill Valley, where she is an active community volunteer and serves as a trustee for World Learning, the California Academy of Sciences, and Marin Academy. She is also the co-director of the North Ridge Foundation, a family foundation devoted primarily to education and environmental issues. She received her JD from Stanford Law School, practiced law, worked as an editor and writer for the Los Angeles Daily Journal Company, and now is raising, with her husband, three sons. Our final panelist on your right is Nancy Hitz, who graduated from UCLA in 1960, where she met her husband. The two of them then took off on a six-month trip to Europe, traveling in a VW Beetle with a Europe on $5 a day in hand. Those were the days. She worked in Washington, D.C. with nonprofits in education, helping to implement the new public law ruling that all children should receive an education no matter what their disability. In 1999, Nancy and her husband retired to Los Altos Hills, where she has continued to explore the world and is committed to social justice and education for all. And now, the questions. And we've got quite a few from our audience. And while we're doing this, if you still have questions, please write them, and they will come up to us, and we can include them. So I'm going to open, and Kate Ridgway, give you the first one. You were the inspiration behind this trip. What was your goal in putting this group together and going to Liberia?
Okay, what was my inspiration? Well, I think there's really about three things. I got involved with the Carter Center about 6 years ago. I was a huge admirer of President Carter, mostly because of his energy environmental stance during his administration. And about 6 years ago, I asked Rick, my husband, if he would, my dream was to actually meet and talk to President Carter. And so Rick found out that if we gave a little bit of money to the Carter Center, we could go to the winter weekend, and I was able to have dinner with President Carter, which was a life-changing event. And but each time I went off to do something with the Carter Center, I would come back and tell friends about the work of the Carter Center, and they'd say, where were you this last week? And I'd say, I was in Atlanta at the Carter Center. And they'd look at me and say, isn't that Habitat for Humanity? And I'd say, no, that is not that. He's on the board of Habitat, but that isn't the work of the Carter Center. And so I was really amazed by how few people in the West Coast understood the work of the Carter Center, and it became a passion of mine to kind of spread the word about the work of the center. So after President Carter came to the West Coast, my husband and I had him out and had a luncheon and a dinner in Menlo Park. We had a group that got together at a restaurant in San Francisco, and we were talking about how to extend the outreach and basically awareness of the work of the Carter Center. And Nancy Farese and Kate Biggs came to that dinner. And we went around in a circle, and everybody introduced themselves and what their interest in working and helping the Carter Center was. And Nancy, we got to Nancy, and she was just went on and on and on about how incredible her visit with one of the Carter Center projects was while she was in Liberia with Nancy. And then we got to Kate, and Kate was a beam of light and enthusiasm and essentially said, after 10 days in Liberia, the most exciting things she observed was the day she spent with the Carter Center. And the upshot of the dinner was, let's get a group of women together and go to Liberia. see the Carter Center's work on the ground and then come back and basically tell our story. And that's what we did. So we went to and asked President Carter if it was okay if we went and saw his work. And he said, well, we've never done that before, but it seems like a good idea. So here we are.
Thank you. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California's radio program. Our guests are women affiliated with the Carter Center discussing their observations about Liberia as a beacon of hope for the continent of Africa. A question from the audience, which I'll throw to anyone who wants to respond. As an incubator for a new paradigm in development and aid, can you describe how the civil society and the NGO sector has developed in Liberia, and how can the international community support the health and growth?
That's a great question.
Now we're looking for a great answer. Okay.
Wow. Yes, that's a, we could go on all night about that. How can you, first of all, how do these NGOs get supported in Liberia? The Carter Center provides very small stipends or grants or in-kind services to local community grassroots organizations that do all kinds of things. So they are actually not primarily funded by the Carter Center. They get a little bit of funding from the Carter Center, and they patch in funding from other foundations or other international NGOs who then re-grant to them. It's really hard to give to a Liberian grassroots NGO because they aren't often registered as a nonprofit in this country. So there's actually been a very innovative idea that's developed, and there may be people here in the audience who could talk a little more about that. I recognize Devin and Pablo there. There's been something created called the Philanthropy Secretariat, which is sort of serving as a bridge between the Sirleaf government and individuals who would like to become what we call non-traditional donors. The traditional donors are countries that give official aid or large international NGOs that can re-grant to these smaller groups. So there's a really interesting movement brewing within the development field to somehow get money directly to these grassroots organizations without it having to pass through several hands first. So this is something that's developing. I know the Nike Foundation has been very, very involved in trying to help this. There's a group called the Sirleaf Women Market, Sirleaf Women's Market Organization. So I think this is something to watch and see how people are trying to get private money to these local organizations. And the Carter Center, it's never really been their intention to fund these organizations completely. They give a lot of technical assistance and capacity-building help, helping them with management strategies, with communication strategies, with office space or transportation, doing a lot of consulting, even helping these groups to begin raising their own money within Liberia and within Africa, and then hoping to reach out to the international community as well and the non-traditional donors.
Anyone else want to add to that? Okay, we'll move on to the next question. What is the average educational level of the average citizen in Liberia and the leadership of Liberia? And on the area of early education for children, is there equal education for male and female children? And what about secondary education? So we're looking at the educational level that's existing there now, and what's the educational system in the future going to look like?
I think we're all going to have to help each other and answer this. We did meet a lot of the people in the government. We had a dinner with some of the ministers and some of the officials in the government, as well as a professor. There's a university in Ghana. A lot of the people that we met went to university in Ghana. There was a strong educational system prior to the civil wars, and it seemed that we met attorneys, we met health workers, we met doctors. So I think for the people that are really running the country right now, there's a strong educational system. When we did visit the schools, it was clear. It was coeducational. Girls were treated equally to boys. Any other input from what you guys said?
Well, I think we were told that even some of the people in government were illiterate, and we tried to figure out how you would have information when you have an illiterate government, partially illiterate government. That's so they have a long way to go.
Thank you. Emily, the next question I'm going to put to you. Kate mentioned in her remarks that the dual legal systems are important to Liberia. Could you tell us about your impressions of a country that needs to keep both the formal and the informal systems alive and the importance of that?
Yes. As a trained lawyer in America, it was a privilege and an incredible education to go to another country and in the process of developing, like Kate said, after the Civil War, reconstituting and developing a legal system from scratch. And never in my wildest imagination in law school could I ever have envisioned what that might be like. And just to give you a flavor, I think she did a good job describing the formal system. What we mean by that is the statutory codified laws, and they have a constitution a lot like ours. In the recent years, with Ellen Sirleaf as the lead woman, there have been some more recent laws especially favorable to women. For instance, marital rape is now a crime where it wasn't before, or there are new laws against domestic violence and also new laws where women can inherit property. So I can understand as a law student that all makes sense. They're in the books. They're there. But then to think, it never dawned on me just when you have a tribal kind of customary culture for all these years, how do you translate that? How do you possibly translate it? And so we got to witness, we went out on a bus through rotted roads you can barely drive and to the middle of nowhere with dirt and red, you know, dust everywhere and insects and the tribes gathered together, kind of a different areas came, but the same speaking tribe gathered for this education that the Carter Center provided with their local partners. And it was the first time, at least as a witness, it seemed to me the first time that this tribal village had been exposed to some of these new concepts. These new laws had been passed, and maybe people knew more about it in Monrovia, but they didn't in this rural area. And so how they translated it is the Carter Center partnered with a modern drama company, really talented kind of improv, young, you know, smiles, just incredible improv. It could have been on a San Francisco stage. But there we were in the middle of nowhere, and the tribe gathered around in a big circle, and the stage was just the dirt in the middle of all of us. And we witnessed, it was translated for us later, but they spoke in the local dialect. And they acted out a skit, one of which was a young woman in their village whose husband had died, and now she was being kind of commandeered and forced to marry the brother. And it was very dramatic and partly funny, and you could tell by the way she acted in her body move that she didn't want to marry the brother. And so they explained through the skit and through this incredible improv that she really didn't have to marry the brother anymore, and that also she could, because her husband had died, she had inherited some of the property rights. And so we watched this flicker of, acknowledgement in the people's eyes, and we could only watch their body language because we didn't speak their language, but you could tell that some of the elder men were upset, and it was fascinating. But what it made me realize about the translation of law to a traditional customary culture is how hard it is and how much manpower it takes. And I truly can't think of another way to do it except to kind of go village by village. And that's why I was very impressed with the dedication of the volunteers who are earning almost nothing in this place where you really don't want to be to get these laws across. And I think it's going to take a lot of time and generational change, but it was fascinating, and also I had a great respect for the humanitarianism of the people that were involved.
Thank you, Emily. Nancy, what is the predominant religion in Liberia, and how are the churches being influential in the reorganization of the country?
The predominant religion is Christianity. Probably about 85% of the people in Liberia are Christian, with some combination of tribal rituals combined. I think about 12% is Islam, and the laws say that there's religious freedom, And so therefore, it works quite well. There are some tensions, but it hasn't been too bad. We had an experience on a Sunday morning that we were there. We attended a church in Monrovia, in the Secor area of Monrovia, St. Peter's Lutheran Church. Many of the Americos that returned to Liberia brought their religions from this country, and so there are many of the traditional religions, the Methodists, the Lutherans, etc. The church that we attended was the church that in 1990 several hundred people went to and were housed and fed to get away from the violence that was going on. On July 29th in 1990, the army broke down the doors, and during the next 2 days, 600 people were viciously slaughtered. And this was the largest massacre in the country. It was such a meaningful opportunity to be there, to see the vibrancy of the people, the women who were in the church, the singing, their beautiful, colorful tribal costumes that they wore. It was just very touching and to be in that situation. The mass grave is under the parking lot outside the church. It has a large star on it. Cars were parked all over it because there was no other place for cars to park. The church plays a large role. I think on Sunday morning, everyone was in church of some kind. And you see signs of the church being important in people's lives.
I was just going to say that one of the impressions that I had, or thoughts that I had in terms of organizing in Liberia, is that, you know, if you get a large group of people gathering every Sunday morning, the church can play a great role in organizing people and making a difference. And one of the questions I had for the Carter Center was, you know, do you work directly with the church to educate, to implement changes, and to get people to talk? So I really think that it's a great, there's a lot of potential if churches are worked with and partnered with when you're trying to bring up a country like Liberia right now.
And the churches have played a traditional role in helping the communities during the war and in the aftermath. A lot of the social services came through the Christian organizations that had been there the longest, and the NGOs often got involved with them first and then branched out into the areas that the Liberians identified through those organizations that were already there.
Let's move to another area. In the U.S., we're very heavy on information and communication. Tell us a little bit about what the situation is in Liberia. Do they use the internet? Do they use cell phones? Do they rely on newspapers? Are there bookstores like we know them here in the States? How do people find out what's going on in their country? Kate, you mentioned that in your...
When Nancy and I went the first year, we were completely blown away that there was absolutely nothing to read. There's no magazine stands or no bookstores. We had some old New Yorkers and Time magazines from the plane, and people just were grabbing them hungrily from us. I'd unloaded all of my nerdy books about development and civil society, and they were just taking them. I mean, it's really amazing. We talked a lot about, wow, what could we do to... There's no mail service from the United States to Liberia. It's just incredible the challenges they have to actually get information. We're so spoiled here. But they are starting to have more and more access to the internet, and cell phones are a huge, huge thing there, as they are across Africa. I mean, they're not even rebuilding landlines in Liberia. They're going right to cell, as they are a lot in a lot of other countries in Africa. And there's tremendous potential there for information, not only news, but crop reports and market conditions and all sorts of things that go into development. That communication is coming via cell phones now. Do you guys want to talk maybe a little bit about the Thai house that we saw, which was an incredible forum of debate that we actually witnessed in the middle of this very busy street of Monrovia, where people would gather to have debates like we're used to seeing on Larry King or on Meet the Press. I mean, people just flood this place all day long and gather. Government ministers come. People from the Carter Center come. People who just are working downtown and want to come and find out what's going on. And that's where a lot of the debate, especially about the presidential elections, is going on. We actually were there right when the president had just dismissed her entire cabinet. She just cleaned house and let it be known that she didn't promise to hire them all back. So there was a huge shakeup going on in government, and nobody had any real way of knowing what was going on, which ministers were getting reappointed, which weren't, what this meant about corruption or about loyalties within the government, what it was going to mean for the election. And people literally were on the street having these incredible forums of debate there. Did you guys want to talk about it? I know, Emily, you were really moved by the Atai House.
It was crazy. I can't, almost like a mob riot type of scene, but within a construct. Like, they had very formal rules about speaking and being respectful for each other, and even if they had very differing opinions, there was one moderator that kind of controlled the differing voices. And it was democracy at its finest, honestly. Except those all men. But besides us, in the middle, surrounded, trying to drink our tea, there was just, maybe 100 men, but all with opinions and different viewpoints, but really listening to each other. So it was one of the hopeful things we saw in Liberia. And as far as the other communications, you can't even believe the cell phones and where they are. Like, you think you're in the middle of nowhere with a tribal elder, and his phone will ring. He's talking to you, and then it's like, hello. And that really struck me. And also the cell phone companies are coming in with such force that they're offering to paint people's houses. Like, if someone wants their little corrugated place painted, they'll do it for free. And so they paint it in, Vodafone yellow or neck. You can't – everywhere you go, it's like billboards, but it's actually – the huts are painted to the colors of the cell phone companies. But they're really taking over.
I'll make one other comment on the Atai House. When we were there, there was a lot of banter and a lot of debate going on, and the comment that I made and the takeaway I had was a lot of the discussions were exactly what we talk about in the United States, just a different level. So I thought that was really fascinating. A lot of the concerns were just like our concerns. So.
Radio is also a great means of communication. People, because so many are illiterate, radio is one of the means if they are in a place where there's electricity and they or that they can get batteries.
Kate, you mentioned that the current president of Liberia is a woman. I would like to throw this open to all of you. What did you perceive as the role of women in Liberia while you were there?
Well, this wasn't while we were there, but before Sirleaf Johnson was elected, during the war, the women became just so distraught with what was happening in the war that the market women banded together. And in this case, it was the Christian women and the Islam women went together to have a sit-down strike, and they essentially ended the war through their sit-down strike. This was an incredible thing they were able to do. And then they were very supportive of Sirleaf Johnson and helped, I think, get her elected. The women are very powerful. They just are such strong women.
I would say it was surprising to me that these women had been sort of subjugated for so long historically and culturally in Liberia, because we saw examples of very powerful, dynamic women. I remember at one point I thought, if half of these women that we met came back to the United States and moved to L.A., they'd be on TV, because they were just vibrant in a way that I don't think we see very often in the United States. So I was really, really impressed. A lot of young women really involved, really caring, and making a difference. In fact, I would say I felt as though we saw more women leaders than I felt we saw male leaders in Liberia.
Within the government, I'll just make a quick comment here. I mean, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf certainly made her way where she is. She had served in a bunch of different capacities through the UN and private sector, so she's very much of an example. She's there a lot as much because of her experience as she is because she's a woman, which is really, I think, a really important message to model. And she's tried really, really hard to fill her cabinet with women leaders and to have local leaders and to develop this network. And she is very strident about the fact that she thinks that women bring different talents to government and very much espouses the current research and trends that we hear in developing countries about what women's empowerment can do for your country and why women are often a better bet for your development dollar. But she's been frustrated that there's just the capacity, the human capacity in the government has been very, very hard to build because the schools were closed for 20 years. And women were not going to school in the numbers that they're going now. So it's really kind of a generational turnover that you're seeing, and she would certainly like to have more women, I think, in leadership positions than she's been able to place them so far. But I think they're working on that.
One other quick story. Really quick story. When we were leaving Liberia on the plane, we met a beautifully dressed woman, and we started engaging with her and found out that she had been with AT&T down in the southeast. But she was born in Liberia and left as a child. And she came back thinking to just visit family and people that she knew there, and she decided, I have to make a difference. So she went about kind of looking for opportunities and ended up running the Monrovian port as a vice president, mom, working mom in the southeast. And she went into that male world that was losing money like crazy, and in the 2 years that she ran the port, it was running at a 20% surplus profit margin. And while we were talking, she had gotten a text message from somebody in Monrovia, and she said, I wonder what this is about. And we ran into her a little bit later, and she said, I was just appointed to be Minister of the Commerce. And that was her story from Vice President. And I thought, what a fun, wonderful story that is.
As a follow-up to the last question, what is the most effective way that you feel that people can provide aid to Liberia in a society where, to put it modestly, there's quite a need for enhancement of women? How can you provide that aid without giving status quo entrenchment to what is there now?
I mean, I think you can go again. I mentioned Nike because they've been running a pilot program there, and I think their program is very interesting. And there'll be more, I think, that will come online that will seek to specifically target organizations that are already working with women. I think that's the best bet, is to hook up with international NGOs until they can sort of figure out how to get private money to these groups directly who are working with local grassroots groups. And I think what's really interesting about the Nike program, and I believe the Carter Center is involved in this too through Humanity United, is that they're actually training women vendors on the streets or young women who really don't have the luxury of going back to 5 more years of school but could go and become, help in the restaurant and tourism industry. So they're really starting where people are. And so I think there's a number of groups and a whole constellation of NGOs that are already working with women and are really trying to solve problems in the here and now. They need jobs. They need certain things. And then while building this larger place for women in the society. So I would say to work with international NGOs that have connections with local grassroots groups like the Carter Center.
Thank you. Unfortunately, we've reached that point in our program where there's time for only one last question, and I'm going to throw it open to all four of you. What was your impression of people's level of respect for the Carter Center, the United States, and you all as Americans?
When we arrived in Monrovia at the airport, we were picked up by the Carter Center vans, and as we were having our luggage put into the back of the van, people walked by and they said, "Ah, oh, the Carter Center, good organization." These were people just walking by on the street. There is such respect everywhere we went. People are very respectful of the Carter Center.
I felt people were positive about us as Americans and very proud of having a woman. Interestingly, even men too, kind of proud of having a woman leader, and And I felt that the respect for the Carter Center was palpable everywhere we went. And I attributed it to their incredible way that they approach development through almost as anthropologists. And I got this sense way out in the rural communities and also in the city that, let's say, the work they do with the tribal areas in the communities I described before, not only is that helpful to them, but then that information comes back to Nairobi through the Carter Center and all their volunteers, and so the people working to pass the laws are much more in tune with the tribal and customary culture. And I think it was that deep respect everywhere we went. We always participated in the very local customs, and we gave bags of rice or whatever it was. We shared kola nuts. And I don't think that all NGOs everywhere do this. I think it's something the Carter Center's developed over many years of realizing that you have to be so respectful of the culture that's there before you can ever work change. And they did it in so many subtle ways, but the result was people that saw us or met us, strangers, no one that was put up to it, would come, and they were very respectful and very positive and appreciative of the Carter Center. So
we had a conversation with a tribal chief who actually knew a lot about American history, probably more than any of us knew, and we were so impressed by how well-informed he was. He knew about Kennedy and all about our government and our democracy and seemed so excited to talk to us about that. In addition to that, there was also a lot of energy around having an African-American president. A lot of talk about Obama and excitement about that. So that was really fun to see.
Okay. Our thanks to Kate Biggs, Kate Ridgway, Emily Ogden, and Nancy Hitz. We also thank you, our audience here, and on radio, television, and the internet. I'm Skip Rhodes, and now the meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.